Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you saw it so and so's. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Well, your dadgum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government?
Well, welcome to Handling the Truth with the Rebel Madman and Tenacity. I am Terry Dodd, and I am also known as Tenacity, and my co-host tonight, Mike Gaddy, is the Rebel Madman, and you can find his articles at rebelmadman.com. We got a hot show tonight. We're looking forward to getting into the topic right away. I'm going to open this with a quick prayer. Father in heaven, thank you so much for blessing us in the ways that you do. You've warned us in so many ways, and you've blessed us in so many ways, but we recognize that your wrath has to be pretty high right now. So I know we're looking around us, and we see this spiritual battle that's going on, Father, and we just pray that we are on your side of this battle, that we are in your desire. We pray that your spirit will fill this show tonight, fill our guests, fill Mike and I, and fill our listeners, and bring the truth forward, because that's what we're about here at Handling the Truth, is educating people on the facts as much as we can to help wake people up. And we just pray, Father, that you would assist us in that task. Thank you for the guests that we've got tonight. Thank you for really watching over us in this show and giving us this opportunity to be on the front lines of this battle that's going on. We thank you and we praise you, and we know that you are the only self-existent one and the creator of everything. So we pray this in the name of your Son, our Savior, Yahshua HaMashiach. Amen. Well, Mike,
amen.
I'm looking forward to tonight, and I think we're going to kind of take this in a little different direction than the way things go. You know, when this thing about Kamala Harris hit, you were the first one that I heard say it, but I was already thinking it, and that was that it's not by accident that they have put her in as the vice president nominee, and her having the ineligibility that she has, that she's not. She's got divided allegiance, and she making all kinds of really nasty comments out there. But the point is that they put her in there deliberately because they wanted to create a chaotic situation where they could use the race baiting, and they wanted to refuel this eligibility, this citizenship question, as a means to really throw more upset and division into this race. And when I saw how many organized articles hit the internet and Newsweek and USA Today and all of these different outlets, immediately it was obvious that it was pre-planned, and they're already throwing out the conspiracy theory stuff and denigrating people, and it hadn't even hardly got started yet, and they already had it everywhere. So this is not by accident. They want this to be to upset people and to create division. So the first thing that hit me was, who can we bring on here with us that can discuss this in a way that our listeners will really understand and get an education on this? And at the very top of my list was Mario Apuzzo, because I know Mario's been in the front lines of this for, you know, really, what, 12, 14 years, somewhere in that range, at least back as 2008, if not before that. And we were fortunate to be able to reach out to him, and here he is. He's coming on our show tonight. I think this is going to be a phenomenal discussion. Mike, welcome and say hello to Attorney Mario Appuzza.
Sir, it's a pleasure to have you tonight. I've really been looking forward to this since Terry told me you'd be able to make it.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Terry. It's my pleasure, and I really appreciate this opportunity to share my thoughts with you, your show, and, of course, with your listening audience.
We are blessed to have you, sir, and I'd really like to just give you the floor for a few minutes and let people give them a little bit of taste of how you got into the citizenship issue and what your background is, and let them know what kind of experience you've had with this.
Well, first of all, my background, I'm an attorney at law, licensed in the state of New Jersey. I became licensed in 1983. I have my own law practice in New Jersey, and I'm admitted to the, of course, the state of New Jersey courts, Supreme Court here, Third Circuit Court of Appeals, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm admitted to the U.S. Supreme Court. I've litigated cases at the state level, the federal level, and also have filed writs of certiorari with the U.S. Supreme Court in three natural-born citizen cases. I have a varied practice. I cover a lot of ground, and so that's just basically about my background. And I first became involved with the natural born citizen issue back when when Mr. Obama, former President Obama, was running for office. And now we know that that election occurred in 2008, November 4th. And at that time, I had Commander Kirchner as my client, and we filed suit in the federal court, district court. We went to the Circuit Court of Appeals and then to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we were denied on standing along the way. So the courts never really addressed the issue of what the meaning of a natural-born citizen, never got to the merits. So that's basically how it started. And back then, if everybody will remember, Leo D'Onofrio was very active. He had a blog, and he was doing a great job going at it, and everybody was really dug into it. We were doing great research, great writing, and then from there on, it just kept going. So that's just a little bit of the background.
Well, I know that I guess I don't want to spend an inordinate amount of time tonight talking about things. Maybe you can explain the three-legged stool. You can maybe give them a little bit of background on what a natural-born citizen is, just to lay the groundwork for it. But I'd really like to get into some other issues. But I'm going to give you a second, if you will, just kind of give a little bit of that knowledge to our listeners.
Well, based on my research, and I've done extensive research on this issue going back to the founding, the great minds of our revolution, the importance of allegiance to the founding fathers and the framers coming out of the English-American Revolution and the political philosophers of that time, especially Emir de Vattel, who was greatly respected by the founders. He wrote on nature and natural law as applied to nations. He called it the law of nations. The founders were heavily dependent upon his work because of the new nation. It was a new concept for them. How do you create a nation? First of all, how do you break away from Britain? Do you have a constitution? How do you set up a government? What justification could you have to break away from the mother country, for example, sovereignty? What is sovereignty? I mean, if you look at the history, it's full of the framers and the founders relying upon Vattel. And he defined a natural-born citizen in Section 212 of his famous treatise, 1758, which was written in French. But then there were translations after that, immediately after that. Also, the founders, they also read French, and the actual version that was before the Congress back then, they were using it to set up the new country. That was written in French, actually. And so what happens is, basically, he defines a natural-born citizen as follows. First, this is critical, critical, critical to understand. First, he tells us who the citizens are, okay? And this is where the mistake is made today, whether it's intentional or whether it's led to mislead. You know, today they argue, oh, he's a citizen, she's a citizen. That's not the issue. The issue is what is a natural-born citizen. Now, Battelle starts with who the citizens are. And basically, of course, I'm paraphrasing all this just out of my head. I'm not, you know, quoting or reading anything. He says that they're the members of society. They share in the advantages of that society. They have an obligation to perform, you know, duties for the society, and for that they receive benefits. Now, those are citizens. Now, he doesn't say how you become a citizen, which is very important in this whole analysis. But then he goes from there. He says the natural-born citizens are the children of the citizens, okay? And now he also has this concept of basically that you can throw off your allegiance. And that's very important, because when you go back to the founding, that was one of the principles that we had. If you read Wilson, for example, he was a tremendous scholar. He believes heavy into Battelle about how the son of a citizen is a citizen, but you can throw off your allegiance when you become of age. So now, throughout our history, you know, that sets the stage, basically, is the founders, you know, what is this natural-born citizen? And even in the Constitutional Convention, the convention at first, they had just written a citizen, that the president had to be a citizen. They had an age that he had to be a resident. I think it was 12 years at that time. But then later on, it was changed to a natural-born citizen. So that tells you right there that there's a distinction, a critical distinction between a citizen and a natural-born citizen. It's, you know, it's not just a citizen. It's a natural-born citizen. Now, when you go into the Constitution, it was done very cleverly. They basically say if you're a citizen at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, you're eligible. But after you have to be a natural-born citizen. So, again, we have the distinction. Now, I want to go fast forward because I want to make sure that everybody understands this. When you look at the 14th Amendment, talks about a citizen, does not talk about a natural-born citizen. Again, the big question that Battelle left open, how do you become a citizen? And that was debated throughout the years after the founding. But the way the law was, and now when I say the law, if you look at all our naturalization acts, starting with 1790, 1795, 1802, and then it goes on 1855, and just goes on and on. Now, none of those statutes basically act upon a child born in the country to citizen parents. And the reason that is so is because there's no need for Congress to naturalize that particular person. They would not do that. They had no power to naturalize a natural-born citizen. It's a contradiction. You don't need to naturalize a natural-born citizen. So if you carefully study all the naturalization acts, the only person, the only child that Congress did not act upon was one born in the United States to citizen parents, but it acted upon all others. It acted upon children born out of the United States to citizen parents. That was 1790, the first act. And confusion comes in on that because the act says will be considered as natural-born citizens. Well, you know, that doesn't mean that they were natural-born citizens, because if you look at the British the common law and British statutes back then, basically anybody who became a subject after birth, they said they were a natural-born subject. Okay, so you cannot use the English common law. And even Blackstone, he says, when he defines who the subjects are, he goes, oh, he throws it as an aside. And the children born of aliens within the dominions, generally, he says generally, they're natural-born subjects. Okay, again, you know, it doesn't mean that they were actually natural-born subjects, but they were accepted as, they're considered as. So that tells you there, even to 1790, when they passed that particular act, that they were saying, well, okay, there's really no distinction between these citizens. They're as natural-born citizens. But then Congress realized that really was misleading. So in 1795, they did surgical amendment to that particular statute. It took out considered as natural-born citizens, and they said citizens of the United States. And Congress has never touched that again. They never defined a natural-born citizen again. If you look at all their statutes, they're all citizens, either after birth or at birth. The 14th Amendment does the same thing. It naturalizes persons born in the United States to alien parents. It basically naturalizes them. Now, I know there's a big debate about what subject to the jurisdiction means, but we shouldn't get sidetracked with that, which now we've seen that lately with Professor Eastman's article. You know, he talks about the 14th Amendment, and he says, well, these children might not be born subject to the jurisdiction, therefore they're not natural-born citizens. That's really not the correct analysis, and with all due respect to Professor Eastman, you don't conflate a citizen with a natural-born citizen. So the error there is trying to say somebody's not a natural-born citizen because they're not a 14th Amendment citizen. That's not correct. You know, whatever the debate is about a subject to the jurisdiction, okay, let that be what it is. That goes back to the Vattel question. Okay, who's a citizen? Okay, we can debate that. But what is a natural-born citizen, there's no doubt whatsoever. Since the beginning of the nation, it's a child born in the country to citizen parents. Again, it starts with Vattel. You've got a lot of case law that really confirms that. And even as early as with the Inglis was back in 1803, you've got Minor versus Happerstadt, U.S. Supreme Court case, the slaughterhouse cases basically said if you were born in the United States to alien parents, you aren't even a citizen under the 14th Amendment. So that's incredible. But then Wong Kim Ark, that never addressed what a natural-born citizen is. That was just the big question of the 14th Amendment, you know, subject to the jurisdiction. And the court said basically, yeah, if you're born in the country and if your parents are legal residents, they, you know, living here as a resident. It didn't say about, you know, aliens or nothing like that, but that's another debate. So nothing has ever changed the natural-born citizen clause. The 14th Amendment didn't change it. No case from the U.S. Supreme Court ever changed it. All the cases actually confirmed what a natural-born citizen is. And so that's, you know, an overview of this whole thing. Now, again, you know, there is so much information, and I'd like to have some feedback back and forth so we can actually get into this thing. I mean, I just wanted to mention one other thing, the question about English common law. Madison in, I believe it was Federalist number 42, he says that it's dishonorable to use the English common law to define terms in the Constitution. Now, when he's talking about Constitution, he's talking about the original Constitution. See, later on, a lot of detractors from what I'm saying, they'll say, oh, you know, the English common law, we use that to interpret the Constitution. The Supreme Court said we use it. Yes, it's very important when you get into the amendments, because those amendments are concepts that come out of English common law and earlier than that. But so, yeah, you look to the English common law, but you don't look to the English common law on setting up the new nation, constituting the new nation with the original Constitution did. Because even Madison says that it's dishonorable to even think about that. So that's a fascinating statement. I mean, how could Madison say it was dishonorable to use the English common law to define terms in the Constitution? It's right there in black and white. But, of course, you know, the detractors will not even cite that. They won't even talk about that. There's so much information that I want to share with everybody. But let me stop right there because I want to give my host a chance to say something and ask me a question.
Mark, you got something for him?
Counselor, if I remember correctly, There was also a definition of a natural-born citizen in Dred Scott v. Sanford, was there not?
Yes, yes. And again, you know, that's a – now, of course, everybody's going to say, oh, you're a racist, you're crazy. How could you even cite that case? Well, that's not the point. You know, we cite and we discuss everything, okay? We're intellectuals. We're constitutionalists. You know, we're students. We're students of history, okay? So
agree.
You have to – I'm sorry?
I said I totally agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah, so that I look at everything. I mean, whether it's whatever it is, whether it's right or wrong, you look at it because you learn from everything. And so now if you look at Dred Scott, that was 1857, basically the court said, well, you know, the freed slaves, you know, slaves, they were not part of the original society. They were brought here against their will. They were property. So they were never members of the society. And then what happens is if none of them were ever members of the society, then nobody that was ever born here was born to citizen parents. So none of them could ever be citizens because they were not born to citizen parents. See, what happened was with the Civil Rights Act of 1866 and the 14th Amendment, 1868, they fixed that problem because before that, you had to be born to citizen parents to even to be a citizen. There was no way for you to be a citizen. So those particular acts fixed that problem, but they made only citizens. And I can get into more of that with the Civil Rights Act and the 14th Amendment. But the important thing is what Dred Scott said, you know, I mean, they didn't say I'm sorry, but they said, look, this has been our history. This has been our law. They're not citizens. And they cite Vattel. They cite Vattel for the definition of a natural-born citizen, and basically it said they're not citizens because they were not part of the original citizens, and none of them were ever born to citizens, so how could they be citizens? But now, again, you know, in today's standards, we say, oh, that's racist, that's wrong, you know, they were always citizens. Okay, that's a different discussion, but I'm just commenting on the law that the court used to come to its conclusion, so... But anyway, that's, you know, just my comments, my brief comments on that.
Well, I totally agree, Counselor. I really do. And to not look at it in any way as a racial decision one way or the other for this context, because what we're looking at, and if I remembered correctly, the court did address Vattel in that ruling. Am I correct?
That's correct. It did. And it cited him exactly where it defines a natural-born citizen. It was one of the concurring opinions. Justice Daniel, I think it was. Justice Daniel cited him and said, this is how Vattel defines a natural-born citizen. And, I mean, that goes to show you the respect that Vattel had. And there's a lot of case law that cites him going back to the beginning. And so anyway, yes, go ahead. Yes.
When was the last decision, Counselor, that the natural born citizen was actually mentioned in the Supreme Court? Was it in the 1890s or am I incorrect?
Well, actually 1898, that would have been Wong Kim Ark. They
right.
Actually, Wong Kim Ark. United States versus Wong Kim Ark, U.S. Supreme Court, 1898. The reason why I say that opinion, because that's like the landmark case on citizenship. Now, when I say citizenship, I'm talking about answering the question that was left open by Minor versus Happersat. And I'll explain that. See, Minor versus Happersat, they said, okay, if you're a child born in the country to citizen parents, you're a natural-born citizen. There's no doubt about that. Okay, the doubt arises if you're born in the country to alien parents. Then the doubt is whether you're even a citizen. Okay, now before that, the Slaughterhouse cases had said that you were not a citizen. If you were born in the country to alien parents, you weren't even a citizen. You were not subject to the jurisdiction. But Minor didn't have to address that question because Virginia Minor, she was a somebody born in America. Her parents were citizens. So the court said, you know, there's no doubt that she's a citizen, because she only had to be a citizen, fall under the 14th Amendment, because she argued that she had a right to vote under the 14th Amendment and the privileges and immunities provision, you know, where you have these rights. And she was saying that voting was one of the rights under the Constitution. And the court said, no, it's not. It's not a right under the Constitution. The states give you the right to vote. So basically, so Minor left that question open as to what was a citizen in terms of, you know, a child being born in the country to alien parents. They left that question open. Now, some of the detractors, naysayers, whatever you want to call them, they'll say, oh, Minor didn't say that they're not natural-born citizens. That left that question open, and Juan K. Mark, later on, 1898, answered that question. That's false, because Minor did not leave that question open as to what a natural-born citizen is. I mean, there's only one definition. There's only been one definition ever since the founding, you know, starting with Vattel. And there are even other writers like Pufendorf. If you look at Pufendorf, you'll see where he talks about the original citizens. The original citizens are those who create the society and their descendants. And their descendants. He calls those the indigenous. Okay, now, we have more citizens than that, because you could come and you could naturalize. Like two people can come here, say they naturalize, and then they make a child. He's born here. That child is a natural-born citizen under Vattel, because it's a child born in the country to citizen parents. But if you want to talk about the original citizens under Pufendorf, they're the ones who make the society, and their descendants. Even David Ramsey, he's another great source to look at. He wrote a dissertation on citizenship. He talks about the right of citizenship only belonging to those who were born in the country to citizen parents. Ramsey was the first historian in the United States. Okay, so there's a lot of sources for this. So going back to Juan K. Mark, basically, why do I say that it cited natural-born citizen? Because they actually cite Minor, and they don't disagree with Minor. They don't say Minor is wrong to say that a child born in the country to citizen parents is a natural-born citizen. They just they go from Minor, and they answer the question left open, and they address the 14th Amendment question, what is subject to the jurisdiction. Juan K. Mark relied on the English common law, which was very loose. You know, anybody born in the king's dominions and under his protection was considered a subject of the king. But again, going back to my earlier comments, everybody was a natural-born subject if you became a subject. They didn't distinguish between a subject and a natural-born subject. And they didn't have to, because they didn't have a constitution like the United States, where it's critical for us. We have a president and a vice president, and they have to be natural-born citizens. And then we have our statutes, and the rest of the Constitution talks about a citizen. So we have to distinguish between the two. The British didn't have to do that. So you really can't rely on the English common law, because they throw that word around very loosely, natural-born subject. So that's why I answered your question with Juan K. Mark. But there are other cases after that mention natural-born citizens, but they're really not I mean, a lot of them talk about people born out of the country. And they're very important cases, because basically the Supreme Court there says that if you're born out of the country, you're an alien, unless there's a naturalization act that makes you a citizen. So that disqualifies Ted Cruz, for example, because he was born out of the country to alien parents. He needs a naturalization act to make him a citizen. Again, that's all U.S. Supreme Court cases. Even Juan K. Mark said that if you're not born in the country and you don't have a statute, you're an alien. You've got to be naturalized. Even Juan K. Mark says that. But that was not the main issue in Juan K. Mark, because Juan was born in California to alien parents, and the court said that because they were there, they were legal, they were domiciled. That was a very key word in the history of our jurisprudence. Domiciliary was very important. You know, they were domiciled there, which meant that they were legal. They were allowed to be there. You know, consent of the nation, and the court said that the son was a citizen of the United States under the 14th Amendment, not a natural born citizen. But anyway, go ahead, please.
Well, if I remember correctly, in 2008, during the presidential campaign, the candidate that received the most scrutiny about being a citizen was actually John McCain. Am I incorrect?
Yes, you know, and I'm glad you mentioned that because now John McCain, first of all, he's a Republican, okay, number one. And number two, he's white, okay? Now, when I say white, I'm using that word in terms of how our statistics use that word, okay? I'm not, you know, saying it in some positive or negative way, but the reason why I say he was white, because it's not a racial issue, okay? And it's not some made-up Republican thing, you know, trying to knock out Democrats. Because if you look at the history of all the different challenges, most of them were against Republicans, most of them, okay? Even going back to Chester Arthur, he was a Republican. And most of them were white, most of them. You only had, like, Barack Obama. He was black. But then they say you're racist if you argue natural-born citizen, okay? Or it's made up by the Republicans. Totally, totally not supported by the evidence. Okay, so now McCain, again, Republican and white. He was born in Panama, Panama Canal Zone, but he was in a hospital. So, you know, my opinion about McCain, if you look at Vattel, you can't take a part of Vattel and not take another part of Vattel. Vattel says if you're born in the armies of the state, okay, now he says armies because they didn't have air forces and space force and, you know, all this sort of thing. If you're born in the armies of the state to parents who are serving their country, who are citizens, those parents have not quitted their country. They haven't quitted it. Or even if you're born to parents in the diplomatic service, okay, you're deemed to be born in the country and you're a natural-born citizen. So McCain, in my opinion, is a natural-born citizen, okay? Now, I'm not saying that I support McCain's political doings, you know, while he was in the Senate, but again, you know, I call it the way it is, and I think that he is a natural-born citizen, and he was challenged. So yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's very important to show that he was challenged before Obama. So nobody said that was racist or anything. Okay, so go ahead, please.
Well, my other contention would be that the Republican Party, and let me stipulate, I'm apolitical. The Republican Party would be in a great position of at least a moral position right now had they dealt with Cruz and Rubio in 2016. What is your thoughts on that?
Yes, and I did file an action against Cruz, which I took it to the Supreme Court. Again, you know, he got this question of standing. They never really answered the question. And also Rubio, I also challenged him. And again, we're in the same thing where they just turn a blind eye to the question. It's a constitutional question. They just poo-poo it. They don't want to be bothered with it. They're embarrassed. You know, they don't have the courage. They act cowardly when it comes to the question. They have no courage to actually give their opinion. They run away from it because they think that somebody's going to think that they're foolish, or that they're racist, or they're stupid, or they're conspiratorial. Okay, and they let themselves be bullied into shutting their mouths, which is wrong because you have to stand up for principle. Okay, now I'm not talking about making it partisan or making it racial or you know male versus female, that sort of thing. No, you know the Constitution is what it is, and it sets the rules for our country and our society, and it has to be interpreted and it has to be applied. So it does the most good for the most people. And if you want to change the Constitution, you change it through Article 5, which is an amendment. You don't change it by usurpation, which is what's happening here. You know, the media won't give you the right time of day. The courts, they don't want to deal with the issue. They say you don't have standing. Okay, so if you don't have standing, well, the candidates have standing. The candidates surely have standing. My God, well, President Trump right now, if he should lose to although Mike Pence would really be the because, you know, it's because, again, Kamala Harris, she's running for vice president, but, you know, he could make some kind of argument where the ticket as a whole, you know, because she's on there, she's drawing more votes with for Biden and that sort of thing. She has no business being on there. But the point is that a candidate has standing to challenge somebody who was running. So yeah, we had situations where candidates could have done that. The media, if you look back and you look at the media, or every single article that you'll see where they're like talking badly about what they call birthers, they say, oh, yeah, they were the racists. And even they attacked President Trump. They say, oh, yeah, they were the racists. They said that Obama was not born in America. They're racist. And they never addressed the issue that we argued that even if he was born in America, that he still was not a natural born citizen because his parents were not citizens. So now you're starting to see that a little bit with Kamala Harris. At first, they were doing the same thing. And this is what a technique that they do in the press. And what they do is they'll take somebody who writes something or says something, you know, a tweet or something, which is like the wrong argument. Okay, then they'll run with that. Once they have that as a target, then it's almost like a straw man thing. Okay, they found the target, and now they're going to ridicule it to the gods come home. They'll just go after it, and they never address the real arguments that are made. So I'm glad now that I'm starting to see that they're saying, oh, these birthers are saying that Kamala Harris is not a natural born citizen because she was born in California, but her parents were not citizens. That's the first time that you're really seeing that. So that's a tremendous progress that we have made with this, because with Obama, nobody ever said, oh, they, you know, the birthers, whatever you want to call them, said that he was not a citizen because, yeah, he was born in America, but his parents were not citizens. You won't find that in the media. You won't find that anywhere. Even Mark Levin, oh God, you know, he'll throw you off his radio station if you talk about a natural born citizen, you know, you can't get through to these radio stations. It's a shame. It really is. They won't even let you talk about it. They'll screen you, and they won't let you get on there to talk about a natural born citizen. Yet, they'll talk about everything they want to talk about all their things and this one and that one and the revolution and the political philosophy, you know, whatever they want to talk about. But if you want to talk about natural-born citizens, they'll shut you down.
Well, Counselor, one of the questions I have, and it's always rankled me, is that no standing ruling by the court. And I am doubly rankled when they make the statement that a member of the bar does not have standing. Is there any way to establish their basis for such decisions?
Well, you know, a member of the bar really has nothing to do with standing unless somebody's trying to take away your license or they're accusing you of something, okay? Then, of course, you have standing, okay? But if you're a member of the bar only brings cases for other people, okay, and they're called parties. Either you're a defendant or you're a plaintiff. Now, a defendant, of course, always has standing because you're being sued, okay? The question is, does the plaintiff have standing? And the plaintiff is the person who brings the case. Now, standing
I'm sorry, but my question would be, if a citizen of the United States does not have standing in determining the eligibility of their president, who in the hell does have standing?
Okay, well, the way the courts have defined this, and the reason why they've done this, they basically have made a decision to decide what their agenda is, their work agenda, okay? And they want to limit their work agenda for different reasons. One, because they don't want that many cases, number one. And number two, because they don't want to interfere in politics. So they've created this standing thing. Now, the Constitution has standing in it. I mean, you know, cases and controversies, they call it. But the courts, you know, they shaped that, and they made it into standing. So you have Article 3 standing, and then you also have other standing, a prudential standing, which is even like, even if you can find a standing as Article 3 has it, it's a case or controversy, they can still say, well, you know something, we could have standing, but prudence dictates that we don't take this case. And what is prudence? Prudence is going to be, well, you know, we don't want to create a political nightmare here. You know, Congress should deal with this. The administrative system, whatever you want to call it, so they don't get involved in that. Or with natural born, they could say, well, you know, let the people vote, let them decide, which is totally, I don't agree with that, because, you know, the people should have guidance as to what a natural born citizen is. They need that. But again, they say that a regular citizen, a voter, does not have standing because it applies to so many people throughout the country. You know, everybody's affected by whether you're a natural born citizen or not. You know, the president, that is. So if that's like one of the red flags for standing, if it's a generalized grievance, if so many people, if millions of people are affected by it, then you don't have standing. Which again, you could kind of argue that, like even in the environmental litigation, you know, sometimes these people, they won't have standing. And then sometimes they will. I mean, standing is very complicated. It's very sometimes it's even arbitrary. You know, if the court wants to find standing, they can. That's my opinion. They can do it. They'll find anything. Oh, well, he had to spend $5, in order to do this, so he has standing. Or if they don't want the case, they'll tell you, oh, well, this is a generalized grievance. Let the public decide. Let them vote. You know, whatever. So the standing thing is a big problem in trying to attack the question of who's eligible. And if Congress doesn't do anything, like even when they confirm the Electoral College, if nobody stands up and does anything, and then you're stuck, because then all you could do is just rely on the candidates. And another place where you could maybe do something, which has not worked because of they won't give you the right time of day, are the state courts. With the ballot challenges. Now, some states will give you standing. I've gotten standing, for example, in New Jersey. That was not a question about standing. But then that's a long story there about, you know, what happened in New Jersey. But the point is that the standing thing, you're better off in state court trying to do like a ballot challenge. If you go to the federal court, forget it. They'll knock you out and say it's a generalized grievance. You got no standing. You're not a candidate. And so I hope that helps clarify a little bit of what you're asking about.
Well, Mario, well, it seems to me that sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for, because with the federal courts and judiciary being so corrupt, what if they get it wrong? What if they do take it on and get it wrong?
What if anything you do, the other person gets it wrong, right? What are you going to do? I mean, that's life. That's life. You know, you take chances. You take chances based on what you think is right. So, you can't say, well, I'm not going to do it because, what if they get it wrong? Well, then you didn't do it. Nothing happened. And that might be a worst result. At least if you do it, there's a chance that they might agree with you. So, plus, you at least the issue is discussed. You can, I mean, look what happened here. Everything that we did going back to Obama, now the nation is ready for this. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of writings that are going on, the articles, the discussion. I mean, we didn't have this with Obama, like with so many people. There was, it took a while to educate so many people on this issue. Now, the American citizens are really—I mean, they're really good. There's a lot of bloggers and writers, and writing really great articles on this. And so, even if you fail, you'll succeed, because at least maybe next time around you've got more people who understand it. So, let's see what happens with Kamala Harris.
Well, I think my point is that when the courts refuse to take a case, as they did when you petitioned the court, sir, when they refuse to take a case, they in fact make a decision.
Well, yes, Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and you're right in different respects, okay? Here's one way you're right, especially the opposition, okay? They'll say, oh, the Supreme Court denied certification, so therefore they agree with what happened, okay? Now, technically, that is not correct, technically, because a denial of a writ of certiorari is not a decision on the merits. It has no weight. It has no validity in terms of, you know, trying to get some merits out of it, okay? Because they have different reasons why they don't take these cases. For example, here's a great reason. Let's say it's standing, for example. Now, when you rule on standing, you don't address the merits of the question. You don't get to the merits. Now, when I say merits, that's a legal term. It basically means you decide who's right and who's wrong, not on a procedural issue, but on the substance. In other words, you know, did the guy you know, run the red light or he didn't run the red light? Okay, that's merits. But if you say, oh, we're not going to hear that case because you filed it too late, you're beyond the statute of limitations. So even though the guy ran the red light and he's wrong and he should have paid, right? You never get to that because procedurally you're knocked out of the box. So that's what that means about merits. So that happened with natural born. The courts never got to the question of the merits. Now, there are some state courts that got to it, like a Kenny, for example, in 2009, I believe, Indiana. And I totally disagree with the decision. They went on the 14th Amendment, and they said, oh, if you're born in the country, you're a natural born citizen. And they have no analysis. They don't even know who Vattel is. I think it was like hilarious. They said some Swiss writer or something like that. I mean, it's just unbelievable the ignorance of our history and the importance of Vattel and the Law of Nations. But again, that's about one of the cases that went to the merits of it. And in New Jersey, the administrative law judge went to the merits, and that's a whole other story. What happened there, but. So, yes, I agree with you that people will think that, they didn't decide it, so therefore what happened is correct, which is not correct. So you got to be careful with how people throw around this thing. Oh, the Supreme Court didn't they denied certification. They denied it, so what happened below is correct. Doesn't mean what happened below is correct. It means that what happened below stands. It stands. It's not challenged, okay? I mean, later on, maybe they'll decide that it's not correct, you know, if they have the right case. But so that's what that means, you know, not taking a case. Yes, go ahead, please.
Go ahead, Terry.
I can jump in. Mario, you know, you've taken a lot of heat. You've kept your passion about this. You haven't burned out on us, and I congratulate you for that. But I think it's important for people to understand somewhere along the way here, you've had to come to some decisions or had some ideas about why you were targeted and why this issue is such a firestorm for them. Can you kind of get into that a little bit? What happened with you, and what did you have to go through in order to try to educate people in the way you have?
Well, you know, back in the day when we were doing battle, okay, and now the battle started again, but let's talk about the battle with Obama, okay? He or they, whoever, to this day we don't know who these people are, but they had this army of people on the internet. Okay, and we called them OBOTs, OBOTS, which means Obama Robot. Their job, whether they were paid or not paid, I'm not going to get into that because they'll ridicule you if you say that they were paid, because I don't have that evidence. I'm not going to say that they were paid, but they were well organized, and they all would come in, just like piranhas, like when, you know, you got a poor cow goes into the river, and all the piranhas, man, they're like, you know, all there. Or all the ants, you know, you got a little sugar someplace, and all of a sudden you got all the ants all over the place. Those were the OBOTs, and they would communicate with each other, and they would camp out on these different blogs. They had their own blogs, but they would also attack other sources. They also attack when you're on radio shows. Like right now, I don't know whether – do you have a chat going by any chance?
A what?
Do you have a chat where they can people can comment on this radio show?
Yes, yes. But if I had people on here tonight, like I saw on the show that the commander was on last night, I would block them. I would kick them out. We watch that chat, and when we get a troll or an obot on there, they're gone.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So you know what I'm talking about, okay? So they go on these shows. They go on the blogs. And they'll attack you every which way you can imagine. They'll go into your background. They'll try to. One of the big things is ridicule. That's one of the most powerful rhetoric the techniques is to ridicule your target. Okay, you identify the target and you ridicule him or her, and you shame them. You know, you shame the person. So that's what they do. That they ridicule and they shame. They won't argue anything. Like they'll basically also they use this technique. They'll say, "Oh, well, how did that work in court? You know, you're a loser. You know, how many cases did you lose? You're a loser." And they'll just keep repeating that over and over and over again. Okay, they'll ridicule you, and every single day there wasn't one day that they didn't do this. Not one day. Okay. And there were certain blogs that were the headquarters of the Obots, and they would go there, and they're very, very, very arrogant. They're very arrogant, and then they like to cite different things, like to show their knowledge. Like every once in a while, they'll throw in there like some kind of scientific stuff or mathematical something or some kind of arcane thing, and then they'll all chime in together to make it sound like, you know, like they're so intelligent and like they know what they're talking about, and then they'll make fun of other people because they don't know what they're talking about. I mean, these are all the kind of things that they did day in and day out. I know their techniques. I know an Obot immediately. I know an Obot. So I'm like, you know, you talk about being an expert. I'm an expert on Obots. I can, you know, remember what was it, the I smelled the blood of an English, whatever it was. Remember the beanstalk, right? I could smell an Obot. So that's what I had to go through. And they attacked me that I'm an incompetent lawyer, and that like with Commander Kirchner that he's paying me and all this sort of thing. It was just like endless and endless and endless. And, oh, how the court should sanction me. I have to be sanctioned. Can you imagine? I should be sanctioned for arguing what a natural-born citizen is. It is so absurd. Like, you know, as a lawyer, I can't argue what I think the Constitution says. Or, you know, all these historical sources, legitimate historical sources that I bring to the argument, and I should be sanctioned by the courts. I mean, It day in and day out. So that's what I was going through. And I'm sure that this will happen again. Now you got it right away. They started with this racism thing. You know, the race, that the Obots are racist, and they're playing the race card with Kamala Harris. And so it started already now with the race, because she's not white, because she's, she's Indian and she's Caribbean. Okay, I don't know what to... You know, we have all these different labels. I'm not going to use labels because I don't know which label is correct. But I'll say she's of Indian, Asian Indian, and her father was Jamaican. So she's, you know, of Jamaican stock, so to speak. You know, born in California, but born to parents who were not residents here. They were here on student visas, is my understanding so far, unless there's more documents. So they're not even like Wong Kim Ark, where the Chinese parents were here, they were doing business here. They lived in, I think it was San Francisco in California. She doesn't even rise to the level of Wong Kim Ark. She was born to two people who came here to study. They were like on student visas, and they gave birth to a child. So they're going to say that that's all racism. That's what they're going to say. Yeah.
You want to make your point?
Well, I believe from my studies, extensive studies into the founding era of this country, we were set up from the beginning with the judicial system, and you might not agree, counselor, but we were set up with the judicial system where everything would end up in their hands to where they would basically control the country. Thomas Jefferson addressed that on several occasions.
Well, you know something? Here's something that's I'm sorry, are you done? Are you wanting me to respond? Or you?
No, yeah, no, go ahead, sir.
Okay. Well, here's a clue that might tell you that they did not have that intention. Okay? And this is ironic. It's ironic that you made that comment. And now, I mean, that's why the beauty of discussing things, you come up with these different ideas as you're discussing things. Here's the beauty now. They, in the Constitution, in Article 3, okay, it says cases and controversies. That's what it says. Now, what that means is this. Again, this goes to the standing question. What that means is this, that judges are not like politicians. They can't go out and you know, do projects. Oh, I'm going to pass this bill. I'm going to pass this law, and that sort of thing. You know, I'm going to let's do this treaty with this country and so on and so forth. They have to wait. They have no active power, like active. They could only do something when you bring a case to them. All right. And now here's a great example. Take a marriage, for example. Okay. Now, if you're married and you have children, okay, you decide what your children are going to eat, where they're going to go to school, how they're going to dress, how they're going to talk, and so on and so forth. Okay, you decide all that. The court has no jurisdiction. Okay, but the minute you give the court jurisdiction, and how do you give the court jurisdiction? Somebody files a complaint. Okay, so let's assume that you file a divorce complaint. Now the court has jurisdiction. Now the court is going to tell you where that child is going to go to school, how much money you're going to spend for him. How much money one spouse is going to give to the other, how they're going to divide up all their property, and on it goes. You see? Now, I give you the example of the matrimonial to make you understand that if the court has no jurisdiction, you're free to do what you're going to do. Okay? Nobody's going to tell you, you know, what TV programs your child is going to watch and so on and so forth, whether they're going to go to, you know, soccer camp or have ballet lessons, and on it goes. But you give the court jurisdiction, and the judge has power, okay? So now the Constitution has this marvelous cases and controversy. Now, at first, you might say, oh, that's a terrible thing. You know, it's terrible. But it is terrible when you try to get the natural-born citizen argument in the court, in the federal court. But then now addressing your argument, it's a great thing. So where the court really doesn't have that power. To go out and run the country, so to speak. Okay? So they have this
Counselor,
limited power. Yeah.
Are you familiar with Luther Martin?
Luther Martin. You mean back religious Luther Martin?
No, that's
no,
Martin
no,
Luther.
No.
Luther Martin.
Oh, that's funny. I had it reversed there. Luther Martin. Go ahead. Refresh my recollection.
Okay. Luther Martin was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. Luther Martin was the longest sitting attorney general in the history of the United States. And at the Constitutional Convention, Luther Martin wrote Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution in the Committee of the Whole. And that entire document or the entire clause that Luther Martin wrote was changed by the Committee of Style outside of the Committee of the Whole, which totally perverted the Supremacy Clause. So I go back to my point. There were people there who intended to put the Supreme Court in positions that they were never intended to have in the Committee of the Whole.
Okay, but what about my point of cases and controversies?
Well, I agree with that, but if the powers of the Supreme Court was changed by the Committee of Style, which had six men, all of whom were Federalists, and five of them were attorneys, and they changed the meaning of the supremacy clause from what Luther Martin had written and what had been accepted by the Committee of the Whole, and they altered that document before it was ratified, then I believe that there was subversion at work here. And that, I think, was plainly done because the person who was writing for the Committee of Style was one Gouverneur Morris, and there is now some papers before the U.S. Supreme Court on how Morris actually altered the Constitution. So I believe if you look at what Luther Martin said to the Maryland legislature, when you look at what he explained to them, what he wrote as the Supremacy Clause, and then what the Supremacy Clause ended up being, there were forces in Philadelphia that were going to change the Constitution to do exactly what they wanted it to do.
Okay, well, okay. I have my little book in front of me here, The Constitution. And Article 6, you know, Clause 2, says this Constitution, blah, 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 it goes on and on, right? All, shall be the
right.
supreme law of the land, okay?
Right.
Semicolon, okay? Shall be, so all those things, again, Constitution, laws of the United States, treaties, and all the laws made thereunder, shall be the supreme law of the land. So now, how's that different from what Martin Luther wanted?
Luther Martin.
Luther Martin. I'm getting him switched around, yeah.
Okay. Luther Martin wrote Article 6, Clause 2, that the U.S. Supreme Court would only have jurisdiction in cases in which state Supreme Courts disagreed. Also, any case tried before the U.S. Supreme Court would have a sitting jury, and the people would be the final arbiters of what was or what was not constitutional. That was Luther Martin's written, that's what was agreed by the Committee of the Whole and then was changed by the Committee of Style.
Mike.
Okay.
Mike.
So.
Yes, sir.
Mike. Commander Kirshner is in our chat, and he asked what the source is of what you're saying right now.
Well, it comes from Luther Martin. Martin Luther. Blah, 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 easy for me to say. Comes from Luther Martin's general information. I'll be happy to provide it for him if he would like to see it. Comes from Luther Martin's own writings and his address to the Maryland legislature in 1788.
Well, you know, the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court is very limited under the Constitution itself, apart from the cases and controversies. When it talks about the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, again, it's very limited.
Well, in all due respect, Counselor, where in the Constitution did it give the Supreme Court in the year 2000 to tell the state of Florida to stop counting votes?
Okay, now that's a different issue. That's, you know, I think there's a big, big issue in the Constitution between what is the United States and what are the, you know, the sovereign states, okay? And, you know, when does the United States, with a capital U, United States, tell the states what to do. I mean, we could argue about that for a long time, and but you know, I think that But then, if it goes to the Supreme Court, what does the Supreme Court do? Does the Supreme Court say, oh, you know, this should be a state issue? It should not be like a national issue. The state decides that. That's a very, very tough question, and even if you go back to the founding, I think you mentioned the Anti-Federalists. You know, that was really their big issue, was whether or not we were creating this centralized power, so to speak, and it was eating up the states, the sovereign states.
Right. Are you familiar with Robert Gates, Counselor?
Robert Gates.
Yates. Robert Yates.
Wait, spell that again, Robert.
Yates.
Yates. No.
Okay, Robert Yates was also an attendee at the Constitutional Convention from a selection from New York. He was there with John Lansing Jr. and Alexander Hamilton. Robert Yates wrote as an anti-federalist, as Brutus, and just completely ripped apart the judicial system as it was adopted. He later became the Chief Justice of the New York Supreme Court, Robert Yates and John Lansing left the Constitutional Convention in July of 1787, and they said that they had to leave because the delegates were exceeding the authority which the states had given them.
Yeah, well, I can appreciate what you just said, because that was sort of like what I was saying about this controversy. How, you know, how far should the convention go to create a whole new national power, so to speak, or just to, you know, to fix things, so to speak, fix, you know, because I mean, before it was a problem, before, you know, I mean, that's why, like, for example, Shays' Rebellion, you had a Shays' Rebellion, they couldn't even pay the soldiers, and these poor farmers, they were like soldiers, and they couldn't even pay for their farms, the banks were foreclosing, and they didn't have money to pay their debts, they're ending up in jail. I mean, there's a tremendous struggle that we went through as a nation with all this.
Well, how did we get in that financial mess, Counselor?
Well, the American Revolution. Had to borrow a lot of money. I mean, it's one thing, you know, bonds, loans, so on and so forth. I mean, when you have a war, if you don't have money to pay for it, everything's on a debt.
And who was in charge of the finances for the Revolutionary War, Counselor?
I can't say that I specifically know. No, I don't know.
Robert Morris. Robert Morris was given almost dictatorial powers in 1781. Robert Morris actually stole money that was given to the United States from France and put it into his own bank, and then loaned money to the United States government. And many, if you will go into a lot of detail with Robert Morris, you will find out, to the anti-federalist Samuel Bryan, Robert Morris ripped off the United States to the tune of about $17 million from 1781 to 1785. Robert Morris was a member at the Constitutional Convention, and he ended up being a senator from Pennsylvania in the first Congress. And yet he made provisions to make sure that the people that he made, the stockholders in the first bank, he made sure that those people were to be paid. And that, if you get into the undercurrent of this, you will find that was the reason for Shays' Rebellion.
Ah, well, I tell you, you know, it's an understatement to say that you're an encyclopedia, and you're well read, and you have a great memory for these areas, for these specific issues. And you know, I cannot compete with you on this, you know, aspect here. On the natural born citizen, I mean, I've focused on just a certain aspect of it. And,
sir, I'm with you on that. I am so with you on that. You and I are buds on that one, I promise you, because I'm with you on that, because I believe that that is part of the disintegration of this country, and I believe it's part of the overall plan to where we ignore the parts of the Constitution that will hold the government responsible, and yet the people have no recourse. But I'm with you on the natural-born citizen, sir. I applaud you for everything you've done on that front.
Well, you know, I really appreciate that, Mike. I wanted to say something else, which I should have said in my opening statements there. You know, somebody might say, well, what is the Natural Born Citizen Clause? Why do we even need it? And there's a lot of people, they write these articles. They're really like inane, but, oh, we don't need it. Back then it was to stop a prince from Europe to come over here. And they give you those same – of course, you know, like nobody's coming here from some European country. So, of course, there's no need for it, you know. But they missed the whole point, or they obfuscate the whole point. It was basically the president, okay, who's the commander-in-chief also. That person has to have undivided allegiance to the United States from birth, okay. I call it unity of citizenship and allegiance. That's what I call it. And there's no conflicting loyalties. No conflicting loyalties. For example, Kamala Harris, you know, her father was Jamaican, so she could have a leaning toward Jamaica, for example, okay? And then her mother was Asian Indian. She could have a leaning for India. Now, that's not to say that I don't like India or I don't like Jamaica. That's not the point. I mean, you know, all these countries, I respect all these countries, but that's not the point. The point is when you get into an argument, let's call it an argument, then it can escalate into a war. okay? You cannot have a conflict of interest, you know? And even in the law, like lawyers, we, you know, we have a client. We have to be absolutely loyal to that client. We cannot have loyalties to anybody else, either like to the adversary, okay? In other words, you know, the other party, or not only the adversary, but some other interest that's not even in the case. Okay, like whatever. I mean, you cannot have a divided loyalty as a lawyer, and you're fighting for your client. That's called conflict of interest. Now, as the president, you can imagine how important that is. You're going to make decisions that affect the survival of your nation. You know, you have to decide, well, do I go to war with this country or I don't go to war? And if you have a president that has any kind of hesitation whatsoever, because he has a soft spot in his or her heart for that nation, for whatever reason, okay, that could cause you to lose the war and lose your life and lose your freedom. So the founders, they said natural born citizen. They figured, hey, you know, if you're born without a law telling you you're a citizen, you don't need a law. It's by your birth circumstances alone. You're born in the country. Now, in the country, what is that? Okay, well, when you go way back, you know, beginning of time sort of thing, it wasn't called a country. You were born, you know, on a piece of land. You were born within the tribe, so to speak. But you were born with, you know, to those tribe members. There was no question. You know, even the American Indians, you had all these different tribes. And then they fought each other. They wanted to kill each other and conquer each other. Why? Because those people, they were born on that piece of land to those tribe members. When they grew up as little kids and they grew up, they were loyal to that particular tribe. And that's how it works, you know, even with nations. All these, you know, we have these wars. World War II, you had German soldiers, you had Japanese soldiers, Italian soldiers, American soldiers, Polish soldiers, French soldiers. You know, the list goes on and on. And they're loyal to their nation because that's where they were born. That's how they grew up. Their parents reared them to respect the nation, and they'll go to war. I mean, you hear these stories about young people here in America. They weren't even old enough to go in the war. They would lie about their age. Oh, I'm going into the war. I'm going to go fight the enemy. You know, they're loyal to the nation. So you need that in the president. And how you do that is to make sure that there's no conflicting allegiances. And here's another thing too. You shouldn't get sidetracked by what another country says is that person's status. Like, for example, oh, does the other country allow dual citizenship or they don't allow dual citizenship? Because, you know, we shouldn't decide what a natural-born citizen is based on some other country's law. We should have a simple rule, very simple. You're born here and your parents are citizens. That's the end of it. Very simple. You can't get more simple than that. You don't have to analyze what other countries say or do. Are they citizens or not citizens? Because, you know, if they're a citizen of some other country, whether they're technically a citizen or whether they have a leaning toward that other country through their parents. Now again, you know, you could be a first generation here, like born to naturalized citizens. You know, that's a little bit of a problem, but it's not a constitutional problem. Because you still have maybe some leanings toward the old country sort of thing. But then, again, you have second generation and third generation and fourth generation and so on and so forth. So I wanted to make sure that your audience understands why we need the natural born citizen clause. It's not something that's outdated to keep some foreign prince from coming over here, you know, buying his way into being a president. That's absurd. You know, the founders, they were much more forward-looking than that. Again, imagine the committee actually saying, no, being a citizen is not sufficient. You've got to be a natural-born citizen. They actually did that in the Constitutional Convention, which that speaks volumes, volumes and volumes and volumes, where they actually made that particular change from a citizen to a natural-born citizen. And, I mean, there's so many points to be argued here. I mean, one other thing I want to really point out is Alexander Hamilton. He had this draft of the Constitution, and there's confusion when you try to understand this. There's a sketch of the Constitution, and there's a draft of the Constitution. Okay, I'm talking about the draft, which came later on. And he basically says that the president had to be a born either a citizen at the, a citizen of the state, of a state at the time, or born a citizen, or born a citizen. And now, clearly, the Constitution doesn't say that. It doesn't say born a citizen, because Congress can make you born a citizen. They can pass a naturalization act that says, okay, at birth, you're a citizen of the United States. You're born a citizen. But you're naturalized. You're naturalized, like Ted Cruz, for example. Or even the 14th Amendment, which basically is a naturalization amendment. You're taking people who are born here subject to the jurisdiction, and Juan K. Marx says they're citizens from the moment of birth. And then Congress confirms that in 8 U.S.C. 1401A, they say, oh, yeah, if you're born here subject to the jurisdiction, you're a citizen at birth. Okay, they use the word at birth in quote-unquote. So, again, you know, that doesn't make you a natural-born citizen. So very important to understand why we need the natural-born citizen clause. You know, it's a national security measure. And why somebody would not want a stronger protection for the nation versus they want a weaker one, that's beyond me. That's, you know, I love when they talk about a suicide pact. You know, that's a great expression. You know, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. Why would you not want a tougher standard for your commander in chief, who's going to be the commander of your military? Why would you want to say, oh, okay, you're okay? You know, would you do that if you had to hire somebody to look over your children, okay, to make sure they were safe? Would you want somebody who's passes a more stringent test, like, oh, I did a background check. You know, he has no criminal record. I know this person, blah, blah, blah. Or you're going to say, oh, well, you know, we should be really nice to everybody. And, you know, let's all have a love fest here. So, yeah, you could take care of my children. I really don't know anything about you. And I don't want to know anything, because if I ask questions, they'll call me a racist. And, oh, yeah, you could take care of my children. I mean, come on. I mean, it's absurd. It's absolutely absurd, you know, the common sense that goes around on this issue.
We've got about 9 minutes left, and I've got a question, Mario, that I think everybody's going to want to hear the answer to, and you may or may not have thought about it at this point, and I don't want you to give up your strategy if you're about to do something, but what do you believe is the way right now to stop Kamala Harris?
Well, that's a very good question, and you really got me on the spot on this one. again, going back to, I had touched upon this about the ballot challenges. I think that there should be ballot challenges filed in every state. Citizens who are passionate about this issue and who are well-read and really, you know their stuff. I mean, some of the things that I'm reading on the internet, some of these articles are excellent. They got it. They understand what natural born citizen is, so they've got the weapon, so to speak, you know, the arsenal to make these cases. And but you got to be careful with that, because you have these strict rules to the timing of it. You got to each state has different laws, so you have to file these ballot challenges within each state, and each state has different rules on standing and who can file a ballot challenge. Some states are much easier than others. And so they have to look at the state law, and there's no question, you know, it'll be a rare case where you won't have standing. But again, I don't know all the laws of all the states, but generally speaking, you're going to be better in state court than you are in federal court. And there's some excellent articles written on this. Right now, it escapes me the name of the person who wrote an article on this, but they argued that. Well-written article that state court is really the place to be. Don't go into federal court, because, again, they get into this Article 3 standing, prudential standing, plus they're going to cite all the case law with Obama. They're going to say, oh, it's a generalized grievance. So the defendant, so to speak, will just make motions to dismiss. They won't even file an answer. You'll never get discovery. They'll just file a motion to dismiss, a 12B6 motion, and boom, the court will say, oh, yeah, there's no standing, dismissed. And that'll be the end of it. So do it in the state courts, file the challenges, and then just go through the state system. You'll end up in an administrative law first, and then from there you'll end up in the law court. And then from the law court, you could make your way up to the Supreme Court of that state, depending on, like for example, Vermont only has two courts. Other states like New Jersey has three courts. But you don't get, automatically get to go to the Supreme Court of the state unless it's an important issue, which this is. So they should be able to take the case. And then from the state court, Supreme Court, you can go to the U.S. Supreme Court. So you can get to the U.S. Supreme Court by...
Time is obviously of essence, and we don't have a lot of time between now and the election. Is there a method of injunctive relief to keep her off of any of the state's ballots?
Well, again, that's the ballot challenge. That will be part of what you file. You know, you call it an injunction. Basically, you're saying a court rule that she doesn't belong on the ballot. State judges, I doubt you're going to get very far with these state judges. They're going to play it safe, and they're going to say, oh, no, you know, she was born here. She's a natural-born citizen. So don't be shocked or disappointed. You're going to have to make your way through the courts and imagine getting to the Supreme Court where they actually take the case. I mean, it would be unbelievable. Now, if one of those states says that, no, she's not a natural-born citizen, you're going to make it to the U.S. Supreme Court because you know she's going to appeal. She's going to appeal all the way, and she's the candidate. You know, she has, although the defendant doesn't need standing, but she's been injured by the state, you know, kept off a ballot. So you know you're going to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. So that would be the best way to go is do the state route and stay out of the federal courts.
Well, I'll give you a chance to redeem against one troll that just got booted out of our chat, trying to say that all of the eligibility cases have been lost. And early on, at the beginning of the show, you talked about them being dismissed and never tried. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Yeah, most of the cases, see, they don't tell you that. They'll just say that they were all losers, this and that. Most of the cases, like, over 90%, probably over 95%, maybe like even 98 or 99%. Most of them were dismissed on standing. Okay, standing. Again, the courts never got to the merits. There's a handful of them. Uncanny is one. Uncanny, which is a state court case. They actually said, oh, no, if you're born in America, under the 14th Amendment. And that's the one where I said they didn't even know who Vattel was. They said, oh, no, you're a natural-born citizen. So, the question, you know, the point that this OBOT, that all of them are lost, that goes to standing, most of it. And when I went to the Supreme Court, they denied certiorari. And again, I had to overcome standing, which I was not able to. They basically said my client did not have standing. So it's not, you know, yes, it's correct that we didn't get to the court to get to the question of the merits, you know, it's misleading, this person saying that all of the cases were lost. It's misleading just to, you know, without explaining that they never got to the merits in most of the cases.
So you believe it might be possible to go to a state court and achieve standing sufficient to get them to stop her from being on the ballot?
Yeah, because you could get some administrative law judge who is very studious and has some courage, so to speak, and say, you know something, I studied this issue, and I spent a lot of time studying this, and I think it's a valid issue, you know, going through all the historical sources, and there's even more that I didn't cite. I mean, you know, we don't have – how much time do we have to go through everything? But you know, but when you write this information, you know, you present it in a lawyerly fashion, you with all the citations and so on and so forth, and, you know, you don't know. You might get somebody who says that, you know, a natural-born citizen, she's not a natural-born citizen. She doesn't belong on the ballot. And the states do control the ballots. I mean, they keep people off who are not of age. If you try to go on there, you're not of age. They won't let you on there. So if they won't let you on there for age, then, you know, clearly they can let you, like, not be on there because of natural-born citizen. Again, but it takes courage and intellectual honesty to get to that.
Mike, we've got about 3 minutes. Any final question for Mario?
Well, there's just, as I'm thinking about this, Counselor, the one thing I still am having problems, and again, I'm with you totally on the natural born citizen. You are spot on with that position. But I am still wondering, looking at the First Amendment and the right to petition for a redress of grievances, if we consider that at all, I'm still locked on how a, as I call them, how a black robe bandit can sit up there and say, no, you do not have the right because you do not have standing, when actually the First Amendment provides that standing.
Well, you know, if you really study this question about a petition, the government, that's like saying that you could you could write an article, let's say in some newspaper, you know, letters to the editor, and you could say, you know, of course, if they let the letter go through, okay, so you said something, right? But then the question is, what happens? Okay, so you wrote a letter, people read it, some agree, some disagree, and that's the end of it. So the petition, the government basically says that, you know, you have a right to speak to the government. You can have a petition. You can go there. You can even protest, you know, peacefully. I mean, that's a joke today. But it doesn't say that they have to do anything. Like, they don't have to listen to you. They don't have to, like, you know, pass a law. I got this petition. I'm going to pass a law. They don't have to do anything. It just says that you have a right to talk and to express yourself, and that's the end of it. So you really can't. You don't get anything out of that. You don't get any standing. There's no case. You know, you could go there and say, you know, I disagree with the pipeline. You know, you shouldn't build this pipeline. It's going to damage the environment. Okay, now the pipeline could be in Alaska, and I'm from New Jersey, for example. It doesn't affect me, or it could affect me. I mean, depending on how you look at things. But so, you know, so it's a petition, but it doesn't give you a right to go to court. There's no case or controversy just because, you know, you disagree with politics or how the government is doing things and so on and so forth. You know, build a wall. Oh, I'm against building the wall. I'm going to do a petition. Okay. The government doesn't have to do anything, you know. The courts, they don't have to do anything.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I thank you for making that statement that they don't have to do anything, because it goes right back to my point that the Constitution was written in such vague terms to be illusionary to the American public, to make them think that they have freedoms that they never really had.
Yes. No,
Mario,
yes,
I really appreciate you being here with us tonight. We are out of time, gentlemen, and this has been an awesome show. Really appreciate you being here. You've been a great guest. And
next week,
we'll be back with Handling the Truth. Mike, have a good night, brother. Mario, we'll get you back on here sometime soon, hopefully.
I'll be happy to do it. We can get into more things.
Get
thank
Commander
you, Terry.
First
thank you, Mike.
Too, so. Have a great night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night, gentlemen.
To your government walls, all of you, you dadgum government, you sorry rattle fratchet, you got yourself an itch and you're wanting me to scratch it. Well, you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government, uh-huh. Oh, don't you know, oh, don't you love them sometimes, hey boy. Shoe-fitting fire starting. Ought to tell you no good preambulatory bone frame and nail it to your government walls. All of you, you dadgum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes.